Senate Finance and Claims will come to order. If you're in the audience, be sure to shut your phones off, and if you're here to testify, be sure to sign in on the sign-in sheets in the hall. Cy, would you take the roll, please?
Vice Chair Glenn.
Here.
Vice Chair Ellis.
Here.
Senator Solomon.
Here.
Senator McGilvery.
Excused.
Senator Boldman.
Excused.
Senator Bartel.
Here.
Senator Mandeville.
Here.
Senator Morgeau.
Here. Excused. Sorry.
Senator Lenz.
Here.
Senator Lang.
Here.
Senator Lynch. Senator Bogner.
Excused.
Senator Cuff.
Here.
Senator Flowers.
Here.
Senator Fuller.
Here.
Senator Vance.
Here.
Senator Pope.
Here.
Senator Wellborn.
Here.
Chairman Asp.
Here. We have a quorum present. We're going to hear four bills today. The first bill we're going to hear is the first hearing for the bill, so it may be a little bit more in depth, but I've been wrong on that before, so we'll see how that works out. So the orders on the board will open the hearing on House Bill 367. Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the committee. I'm Bill Mercer. I represent House District 46 in Billings, and I'm here this morning with House Bill 367. And I guess I want to take you back to the second half of the 2021 session when we were dealing with ARPA dollars both in House Bill 630 and House Bill 632. You'll see from what we're doing here in both Section 1 and Section 2, we're amending session law as opposed to something that's been codified. And as you can see, the instructions that we provided to the Office of Public Instruction on how these ARPA dollars were to be utilized for the OPI Database Modernization Program, we gave a fairly skeletal direction, and you can see it in its entirety on pages 14 and 15, on page 1, and on pages 24, 20, and 25 on page 2.
Representative, do you mean lines?
Yeah, I'm sorry, did I say pages?
You did.
I'm sorry, okay, so let me do that again. Page 1, lines 14 and 15, page 2, lines 24 and 25. So this legislation is designed to be much more, I think, clear in terms of what it is that our expectations are, in terms of what we are acquiring and the utility that we'll have for the system. And so, as you can see, we've tried to be very specific about, we want this database modernization project to, one, facilitate the use of data by school districts, community colleges, and university system to improve academic outcomes and allow evaluation of academic performance. What I like to do is think about this across the continuum. I think there'll be real utility for people in the K-12 environment, but there'll be real utility for us as we're looking at people who have matriculated from our K-12 system, find themselves in community colleges and the university system in terms of how those systems are integrating and how they're working on behalf of students. So subsection 2 on page 1, line 21, facilitate the secure data sharing between OPI and school districts. And then 3, all those stakeholders that I just mentioned, OCHE, the university system, the Department of Labor and Industry, and obviously school districts themselves and state agencies. Then we focus a little bit, as you will see on the next page, on just the mechanics of the procurement process. And you can see that we even changed the sections that you see at the top of page 2. They underwent some amendment even as we worked on the bill in committee. And the more that we thought about this, the more we thought, you know, Montana is rarely the first one in line for IT projects. when significant federal dollars are being made available. There usually are states that have got in front of us in line that have already implemented something. And the more we thought about it, the more we realized it really made sense to ensure that whatever we were going to get as part of this procurement was something that had been test-driven and that had essentially already been deemed as something that had worked other places. And so you can see, particularly on lines 10 and 11, that we're ensuring that the successful offeror would have experience and proven performance in the implementation of this and storage of this sort of data and the sharing of information in two or more states. And if you say, why have we done that? It really took me back, and the chairman may remember this, but it took me back to the MMIS procurement that happened around 2009 for Medicaid management. And there was a lot of discussion in the legislature about what sort of demands should we make as part of that procurement. And there was a real discussion about the incumbent that was providing services in the state of Montana and the other leading applicant that wanted the bid. And there was just a big discussion about, can't we ensure, given that MMIS is being done all over the country, why don't we make sure that whoever we pick has already got an established track record doing just exactly what we're looking for them to do? And we didn't end up putting that sort of a, at least not this precise, a direction in. And I think that for those of you that have followed MMIS, it's been a rough, long and bumpy road, including a change in the vendor. So this is designed to say, we know that there are people out there that are doing this, and we should not sort of roll the dice and end up potentially with an offeror being accepted that doesn't have experience. And the department, we've built in the language in subsection 6 at the top of page 2, lines 3 through 7, we have really restated what is required by the law, which is that the department administration will ensure that this procurement is done in a way that fully complies with the Procurement Act, but the department administration will have a very important role in ensuring that all of these various things that we want to achieve are something that the offeror who is ultimately picked will be able to deliver. Now, if you look at Section 2, you're going to see that we've applied the same exact language in Section 2 that we have in Section 1. The way I would differentiate it is that Section 1, which is modifying Section 26 in the section law, deals with appropriations to OPI and OBPP, whereas the text in Section 2 is appropriation/authorization to spend the federal money. So I think I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman, and happy to answer any questions. Look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there proponents to House Bill 367? Representative.
Chairman S., members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative David Beatty. I represent House District 86, which is comprised of Hamilton and the immediately surrounding area. I'm here in strong support of House Bill 367 for a number of reasons. I think that the description of the bill was excellent by my good colleague, the sponsor. I just want to emphasize the importance of getting this particular procurement right. Right now, as was indicated, this bill has the effect of modifying or amending appropriation language from last session, and that was related to COVID funds that were received and appropriated through House Bill 630 and House Bill 632. House Bill 630, we appropriated a total of $8 million for this particular project. That money must be obligated by the end of September of this year. To date, only $1 million has been obligated. In House Bill 632, an additional $5.5 million was put towards this project, now for a total of $13.5 million. None of that has been obligated it must be obligated by the end of September of 2024. It became apparent that this particular procurement, if it's to take place, needed to be jump-started in order for us to be able to take advantage of the funds that have been provided, once again, as part of COVID relief. The reason that it is so important to get this system into place is that having an excellent database system will allow for a secure and appropriate sharing of educational information across relevant agencies within the state government. For instance, the Commissioner of Higher Education and the Department of Labor and Industry, where many of our workforce and CTE-related programs are located. So this is an historic opportunity for the state of Montana to really make a large step towards having the ability to assess our educational programs from kindergarten through college years, and now, importantly, towards career and technical education opportunities as well. Chairman Esp, I do have a handout here if I can make it available.
Please send one each way, please.
Senator Esp and members of the committee, what you'll see here is a letter that was signed by the chairman of Senate Education and Cultural Resources Committee, the House Education Committee, and myself as the chairman of the Joint Appropriations Subcommittee for Education. It is a letter directed to the Superintendent of Public Instruction, which outlines our concerns and indicates how we think best to go forward with this. We emphasize that House Bill 367 expresses legislative intent, and we wanted to reemphasize that with this letter. You will see in the letter that there's reference to a request for proposal process, which is being managed by the Department of Administration. It is my understanding that that process is now has been initiated. I can't really comment more on the procurement process itself. We also see that we have strongly suggested, and I believe the suggestion has been taken, that Representative Linda Rexton be included on that in that procurement process based upon her knowledge of education. She is a lifelong educator from teacher through superintendent and has been involved in the Education Committee and the Education Interim Committee to ensure that it's clear what legislative intent is. We want to have a procurement that is fast-tracked, that is absolutely legal, and leads to the kind of product that we expect to have. And as was suggested by the bill sponsor and is reiterated in this letter, this state has a history of failures, to be frank with you, when procuring custom-made IT systems. And so we believe strong preference should be made towards off-the-shelf solutions, and we'll see where this procurement goes. But the bottom line is, if we don't get moving on this quickly with clear expression of legislative intent, this opportunity will evaporate because the funds will go away. Thank you, Chairman Esp.
Thank you, Representative. Further proponents?
Good morning, Chair Esp, members of the Senate Finance and Claims Committee. For the record, my name is Dennis, that's with two N's, Parman, P-A-R-M-A-N. I'm the Executive Director of the Montana Rural Education Association, but this morning I'm here on behalf of my colleagues who make up the Coalition of Advocates for Montana Public Schools. The members of that coalition are the Montana Association for School Business Officials, the Montana Quality Education Coalition, our organization, MREA, Montana School Boards Association, and the School Administrators of Montana. On behalf of the coalition, I'd like to offer our full and collective support for House Bill 367. We want to thank the sponsor and those who have worked with the sponsor to bring this bill forward. Particularly, we also want to note the co-signers on the bill, which include the chair. There's no fiscal note, as you know, for House Bill 367, but as noted by the sponsor, there were funds that were designated in the 67th legislature for the purposes described by the sponsor. These funds really need to be spent within the time frame that are set by federal regulations, spent for the purposes that are outlined in House Bill 367, spent appropriately with assistance of the Department of Administration, and implemented efficiently and effectively, and most importantly, securely, so that 2 years from now, we can have a conversation about the data that we have from a system like this, and that will provide all information to all stakeholders, but particularly I think you as legislators will find a great benefit from what we hope to be the outcome of this procurement process. You know, after 44 years in public education and 7 years in leadership at the Office of Public Instruction, I understand the importance of the procurement process, the implications of off-the-shelf versus custom coding products, the critical importance for data security. We believe that House Bill 367, as amended before you this morning, addresses all those concerns. We would ask the committee for their favorable consideration and a due pass vote. Thank you for your time this morning, Mr. Chair, and for all of the committee, your service to Montana.
Thank you, Mr. Parman. Further proponents? Further proponents of the bill? Katya, are there any online?
Mr. Chair, if the person who identified himself or herself with Great Falls Chamber is not to speak on this bill, then we currently don't have anybody on Zoom to testify on House Bill 367, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any opponents in the room? Opponents, please. Any opponents? Seeing none. Informational witnesses.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Jay Phillips, that's PHILLIPS, Chief Financial Officer for the Office of Public Instruction. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Further informational witnesses. Welcome, Director.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Misty Ann Giles, GILES, Director of Administration. Here for any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Further informational witnesses. Seeing none. Questions from the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, Senator Solomon.
Yeah. This process is something we're trying to fast track a little bit, and can I have Director Giles just for a second?
You're welcome to ask her a question.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Director.
Mr. Chair, Senator Solomon.
Where are we at?
In the process?
Yep.
We've had some really fantastic meetings with OPI over the last few weeks. We're scoping the RFP. I think we're in final stages of feedback, and then we're looking to publish that out. We're going to do the short form process, which will mean we'll put it on the street for about 3 or 4 weeks tops, and then quickly move to the interview phase. So we're hoping to have this buttoned up, I would say, in the next 6 or 8 weeks, if we can make everything align.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Director.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Senator Pope.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think perhaps for the sponsor, Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. Mr. Chair, Representative, just curious, is this, because of the timelines and we're trying to fast track and whatnot, do we already know the answer that there are two or more? There are vendors out there who have already delivered to two or more states. In other words, is this already sort of a known entity, or are we still thrashing around trying to find whether there's anyone who could deliver this software, et cetera? Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pope, thanks for the question. I guess this may not be a totally satisfactory answer, but at the end of the day with procurement, what really matters is who decides they want to apply and try to be the vendor for the state of Montana. So do I believe there are vendors that are qualified? Yes. But we have to see after that RFP goes out who actually applies and whether the credential is met. So I'm confident that there are candidates in the pool that can meet the requirements that we've set forth in the bill.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Senator.
Thank you. Representative Mercer, thank you. in the event that we find it's all about this competitive bidding environment that we're trying to create. We're both trying to create a fast track and make sure we get really qualified candidates. And on the other side, we want to keep it open enough so it is a competitive bid. What happens if we pass this bill, Mr. Chair, and we do not? We have several bidders that meet the qualifications set by this bill, which I understand the spirit of this. I'm just trying to test this thing. What if we do have a couple vendors who are competitive and have done this in two or more states and so forth, and their softwares are just expensive as all get out? You know, in other words, where do we get to the point where we have to say in Montana here, yeah, we could go buy an off-the-shelf, which I think is the way to go, and it's going to cost 2x because so-and-so in Missoula can do it, whatever. I don't want to go there, but you get the spirit of it, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, do we have a plan B in the event that we pass this bill and we can't pay for it? It's too expensive. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pope, I guess I ultimately am going to want to redirect the question to the director, and frankly, Representative Beatty may want to say something there as well. But I'm going to attempt to answer the question, which is the fact that there are a number of vendors providing these services nationally, I think actually I think the probability that we would get only bidders that try to shoot the moon, given the available resources we have. I think the fact that this exists, this sort of approach exists in other places and has been implemented in other places, mitigates against that risk. But at the end of the day, we have the amount of money we have that, as Representative Beatty sketched, that's what we have. And the director has a mechanism at the end of the day where she can always demand that people make a best and final offer. So the procurement process has to be open. It has to allow anyone who is going to meet these criteria to come forward. And at the end of the day, she has to run that process in a way that it will yield a pool that will work. And if it doesn't, then we will be back to the drawing board. But I guess I'm relatively confident given the fact that, again, we're not in the front of the line. And we're not the only one trying to acquire these services. I believe that we will have candidates that are able to do so with the authority we have. But I would like to redirect to her, if I may, Mr. Chairman, so she can weigh in on that. And then maybe if Representative Beatty wants to comment, he may want to have a second redirect if you're willing to accommodate that.
Well, if you're willing to yield the floor, Representative, I'll get Director Giles up here. Director Giles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pope, so a couple points to clarify Representative Mercer's points on the question. So, there are a lot of companies, at least on our initial market research, we think there's about 10 or 12 that offer this. We've got a scan of other states and what they've done to try to help OPI with this fast-track procurement. It's easier for us and them if we've got some of that research as we charge ahead to cut some time off of this. But to Representative Mercer's point, there's a few tools in the toolbox. So first and foremost, throughout the RFP process, first we're looking at the white paper proposals, right? And cost is a part of that scoring. And then that's where we flush a lot of that out in the interview process. In the event we are concerned about admin fees, O&Ms, things like that, that is usually when we do trigger a best and final offer to get those competitive costs down. In the event, though, however, we did run into a potential where this is just going to blow the budget. $14 million is not going to be enough. We've seen this with a couple systems that are tickling around in House Bill 10. We can still move under contract, but just know we would only be able to do so much of that work and then have to come back to the legislature. It does happen. We're confident it won't, but you never know.
Thank you. Good luck.
Further questions, Senator Wellborn?
Thank you. For the sponsor, please.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wellborn.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mercer, I'm just curious. I mean, there's quite a bit of latitude in this proposal. Who makes the ultimate decision on this purchase? Is it OPI? Is it Department of Admin? Is it Interim Budget Committee? Is it the Budget Office on the second floor? I mean, who squeezes the trigger when this is ultimately deemed ready to go?
It's definitely not the legislative branch. I think at the end of the day, the Department of Administration is the one that makes the final decision.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Lynch?
Yeah, question for the sponsor.
Representative.
Since my favorite chairman is here in the subcommittee morning, my labor law attorney, I have to ask him a question. No disrespect to you, Chair Esp. I just a quick question for you, Representative Mercer. When we talked a little bit about the timelines that we're 6-8 weeks out to have in the RFP, do we need this bill?
Mr. Chairman, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you, Senator Lynch. We absolutely need the bill, because if you look at the section law that we had on the books when we walked out the door in 2021, we didn't have enough of a scope in retro. And you know, you recall how quickly all that work was being done. But I think what we've done here is really given the director and worked to try to say, this is what we want in a system. We've got to have this amount of functionality. And I think that's going to allow the procurement to be more effective for OPI and for the Department of Administration than just with that language we have. So I think it's pretty critical that we have the bill, so we've got a clear marker in terms of what it is that we're trying to acquire, what functionality it needs, and I think it'd be a mistake not to put those sideboards up.
Follow up. Mr. Chair, Representative Mercer, so just, I guess, one thing. I know you spoke a little bit about MMIS, and I think there's probably some mutual shared frustrations, not just with that project, but with others, and I think probably others in the room as well. One thing I've always been curious, or I've always wondered, and this may be a nice place to test it, but everything else in state government, we pay for services after they're rendered. You know, you go build a bridge, then we reimburse a contractor. We don't front load that. But in the IT world, for some reason, we front load IT spend. And then we don't get deliverables, and then we get upset, and then we get charged more money to go get the product that we ultimately scoped and bid and agreed to. And I'm just curious, in my professional world, I sell IT, you don't pay us till we actually get it live. And my question is for you, would you be open to some sort of amendment on this that until it's actually stand up and functioning, that's when the dollars start flowing?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, I think that would be a better question to direct to the director. I'll say at the outset that the way I understand the way this procurement is going to work is price is going to be an important consideration to the way the application gets scored. And so the department is going to know, and OPI is going to know what those offerors say how they're going to meet these specs, not only what the product looks like, but what it is that it's going to cost us to acquire that product. I guess my immediate reaction is that if we are dealing with vendors, if our pool or if we have at least one that has that degree of experience in delivering these sorts of systems in other states, I don't think we're bearing much risk. I certainly understand your larger point that maybe isn't the way it always works, but I think with the language we have here, we're building some insurance in that we're going to have something that is functional. But I think at the end of the day, the procurement's got to go forward based upon the price that the offeror is willing to pay. But the director knows, I'm sure, has something to add there for the committee.
Redirect, please.
If I may redirect, or the Senator.
Director Giles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Director Giles, I guess, I don't know if you heard the question or not, but really what I'm curious about is everything else in state government, for the most part, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, we pay retroactive. You know, services are delivered. Somebody takes care of a foster kid, or they go to a hospital, or they pave a highway, or they build a bridge, and then we pay based on an invoice. In the IT world, for some reason, we started the trend that we pay and front load before anything is actually delivered and stood up. And I guess I'm curious, would you be open to an amendment that says, you know, portion of payments held back, or all payments held back until the system's actually up and running and functioning before payments rendered?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, that's a great question. So with IT, as you do know, it works a little bit different, where it is either a front load or usually a task order model. I will say with the these funds, and I would defer to OPI, there's hard obligation dates, so we will have to more front-load those contracts just to meet their deadline and, you know, make sure the funds are obligated so they're not having to turn money back over to the feds. But the tool we use on the backside, if we do ever have to front-load a contract, is we do a performance bond. So we have some triggers that we can get that money back or, you know, maneuver as a state. So I don't really know if the amendment would work on this IT project just due to the strict requirements under House Bill 630 and 632 for those funds to be obligated by the 9:30 deadline.
Question.
Director Giles, have we ever collected a performance bond as the state?
I would have to follow up on that. I'm not sure, Senator.
Thank you. Please do.
Thank you for the questions, Vice Chair Glim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mercer, you spoke. My question is a little bit about the product, and I don't know that much about this kind of stuff. But so you already spoke that as a student would matriculate to the upper higher ed, or even to trade school or something. So you're moving between different agencies or different departments. How far could that go? How can this product continue to follow someone their whole life long?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Glim, we've tried to scope this so we have secure data sharing that would exist between school districts, OPI, the university system, community colleges, and the Department of Labor and Industry. So that's the extent of it. And it's designed to, again, focus on student achievement. So I think it's scoped in a way that it's supposed to have that narrow purpose and can't have any broader use beyond that. And I should say, I know, and Representative Beatty may want to address this, there is ongoing conversation about data governance with respect to this initiative. That would be designed to, I think, kind of put up, again, more sideboards in terms of exactly who's going to have access to the data and how the data is going to be used. So if I may, I think it might be useful for the committee's consideration to hear from him on the progress on that data governance side.
Redirect, Mr. Chairman.
Redirect.
Representative Beatty, please.
Chairman Esk, Vice Chairman Glim. So right now we're in the process of putting together a bill. As a matter of fact, there's a meeting at noon today of stakeholders, if you will, amongst the agencies. I think that we'll address the concerns that I believe that you have about this. I mean, we have a large amount of student data that OPI already collects in various forms, but has a system that makes it hard to integrate it even internally within the OPI. This database modernization program will help solve that problem. But as you can tell from the bill, a functionality that we wish to have within that database system is the ability to securely communicate to designated agencies for the purpose of tracking and assessing the effectiveness of our educational programs K through post-secondary education and CTE training. So what we're envisioning here in this bill, which eventually I hope you will see over on the Senate side, is creation of for lack of a better term, let's call it a data governance board that is comprised of members from the specific agencies, including the Department of Administration, because of the Department of Administration's role in IT security across state government. The idea would be that this governing body would establish the what data might be shared, the means by which it might be shared, and put conditions on how the data would be used. So we're looking for secure and appropriate use of data to drive decisions. We're not looking to open the floodgates, and we're trying to move away from a system whereby there are informal or sometimes formal bilateral agreements between one agency and another, and look at it more comprehensively. So that's in place. The efforts that we have now are modeled after successful efforts at getting just at this question. How do you ensure secure, appropriate sharing of data in a world that is where so much personal information is stored at the state level? This and the effort that I'm working on in concert with a few others is designed to essentially be a companion to the data to the OPI data modernization program.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Beattie. So I don't know if you're going to be able to address this or not, but we recently have seen a bill in here too that is. I'm just a little bit off the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That looked at justice, and it's a pilot program to you could say it's very different, but it's doing the exact same thing. It's taking the person and seeing what the results were of what has that person has been involved with. So this one is education based, and it's going to follow them, and it's going to see where how their education treats them and where they end up, and we're getting data. That one follows them through the justice system and says, what kind of treatment did they get and where did they end up? There's an awful lot of similarities between the two. It seems like it could be the exact same program, just with different data points, I guess you'd say. But it starts to make me wonder, are we building a system that is going to track everybody through everything they do in every facet of their life that government is involved in them?
Chairman Glimm, Chairman Esp, and Vice Chairman Glimm, you know, I was not aware of this particular program, to be honest with you. I know that I have heard talk of some sort of a comprehensive approach to governance of all state data. The effort that I have spoken to you about here is limited to the educational realm. I thought it imprudent to try to address a broader challenge, I would say, which is we collect data. Every agency collects data of various sorts. There is a broader challenge of both securing that, which I think the Department of Administration meets that challenge. But then there's the question of the use of that data and appropriate use of the data. You know, back in my Army days years ago, I remember sitting in out somewhere in various places receiving reports of all sorts of things. You can have all sorts of data, but the collection of it and having it reside and draw dust makes no sense. What you're looking for is key data, and you're looking for how to effectively use it to drive decisions. I think this is a bigger challenge, Senator Glimm. I suspect I share the same concerns you have. The efforts that I've alluded to, though, are very limited in scope, but perhaps suggest a need for careful thinking about this across the entire state government.
Thank you.
Further question, Senator Lenz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lenz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mercer, so I'm kind of left with the thought on this bill of I guess it seems odd that much of this hasn't already been done. You know, I mean, I look at on page 2, act is to provide, on line 4, for increased public confidence in the procedures followed in public procurement. Well, that's great language, but why have we not been down this road before, increasing confidence in the public? And then we seem to be at a bind in our ability to spend the money. If you could address the history of why this is needed, the history of what we're looking at on this, if you could, please.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lenz, I'm going to try to just hit, kind of bulletize it. So, A, we are where we are because the federal government made dollars available through much of the coronavirus relief stuff that is sitting in our account waiting for us to spend it on an OPI data modernization project. I wouldn't be at this podium, I'm guessing, if we didn't have those federal dollars, because we wouldn't have had this chapter law to deal with and to try to flesh out. Point two, to Representative Beattie's point, this is actually something that we're pretty excited about because, as he says, OPI has significant amount of data, but in terms of the functionality, and you know, one of my interest areas here is, I know from talking to various university administrators and community college presidents in the state that we have people that are graduating from our high schools that show up on campuses that need significant amounts of remedial instruction. And you see this in various headlines and papers where it's reported that ACT scores are X, and that means that if you believe what the College Board and ACT says, that means that some percentage are not college ready in math and are not college ready in terms of reading and English comprehension. So we're putting people through a K-12 environment, and then we're spending money on remediation. I think this data system is going to help the data sharing between the higher education system and the K-12 system. So one of the outgrowths of this can be hopefully really trying to drill down on things that we need to try to focus on. And we don't have the kind of functionality across the continuum from K-12 through higher education right now that we are going to have when we obtain this. To your third point on that language at the top of page two, I think some would say, isn't that just a restatement of what the Procurement Act already requires in Title 18? And that may be a fair criticism. We wanted to be very clear here, though, that this is an open process. We want this bill, anyone who's just reading this bill, we wanted them to know, we want all comers, anyone who can meet these specifications, anyone who has demonstrated that they can deliver this product in two or more states, we're interested in having them submit a response to the director's RFP. So, yes, I think we have a Procurement Act that is designed to do what it is, treat applicants fairly and equitably, have adequate safeguards, etc. But we wanted to spell it out right here in the statute because there were questions about, well, is it in fact going to be a fair, open process? And we wanted to be very clear that absolutely. You know, the department is going to have to work with OPI to scope this thing, and then let's see who applies and pick the right one. So I hope that's responsive.
Representative Mercer, Mr. Chair, it was helpful. I thought you expanded on that. But I'm still left with the thought of, so you mentioned that you are here because of my term, the trapped funds, or that we need to facilitate. So this is a moment in time bill, essentially, that you are also trying to expand out the data collection. Am I correct?
Ms. Chairman, Senator Esp, the dollars that we received are not sort of discretionary dollars that we can spend them however we wish. These were dollars designed for this sort of a specific educational data improvement project. So we're here because the federal government made those dollars available. We've got now to make a decision about how to implement those dollars. And I'm here with this bill because, as Representative Beattie noted, we don't have a procurement that has been initiated or finalized, and we didn't have detail when we left here in 2021 in terms of what it was that we wanted to acquire. So I guess I'm here in a moment of time, but I'm here because those dollars were made available. We've got to implement a process now to make sure that we end up with something that is in compliance with what the federal government made those dollars available for. And I think these details are going to help us have outcomes that when we look back 10 years, we're going to say, you know, we scoped this in a way that led to a good procurement, that led to a data modernization system that is serving all the constituencies, from K through 12 administrators to people in higher education, and I think it's going to give us a lot more optics than we have right now across the continuum of how things are going.
Thank you. And final question, Mr. Chair.
Final question.
So I know I've developed some level of skepticism about additional data changing the world, you know. Could you just speak to the fact, because you seem to be sold on the fact that this collection of data is going to prove outcomes, speak to the fact, or is that just going to track how reading and math comprehension just goes down so we can have a good data set on how everything's going back?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lenz, thank you for the question, because you're right that data collection and data sharing alone is only as good as how it is that the people that have the ability to use that data and say, well, what are we missing here? How could we improve something here? Data in itself isn't, you know, it doesn't solve anything. But I guess I'm of the view, and you're going to kind of steal my clothes here, because I want to talk about something that Senator Glimp said. one of the things I've learned in these 2.5 terms, I've been really surprised at how inadequate much of our data is. And this is an example, in my estimation, where we're pretty siloed. OPI has a lot of this data, but because of the nature of the way it is kind of self-contained, I don't think it is necessarily shared across the continuum that we're looking for here to try to improve student academic performance. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm a believer that this is something, can't be sure that we will have improved outcomes, but I think if we have more effective data collection and sharing, it will be easier for a variety of constituencies to say, hey, there's something that we're missing, something right here, and we should be trying to focus on that. So I think it's useful. I want to draw your attention to page 1, lines 18 through 20 in the bill, and this, I think, may be part of Senator Glimp's concern. When this bill was introduced and first heard in House Appropriations, that language read, facilitate school district use of data to drive individual student outcomes. And one of the comments, I think it was Representative Nave, if I remember correctly, said, well, aren't we really just focusing on academic outcomes? I don't remember whether she said, you know, I don't know if she gave any examples, but I'm sure she was probably saying, I don't want this system to focus on obesity. Mm-hmm. If we're worried about outcomes that are academic, then let's say that. So that's why this bill comes to you in the form it does, because we tried to tighten up exactly what it is that we want. What's the purpose here, and what is it that we want to share? So that's one of the things that I think is an improvement from where it started. We're being more precise on, we're only talking about academic outcomes. That's what we're trying to focus on.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mercer. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you for Representative Mercer.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mercer, I guess just going back to the time that we spent together in Section D, we heard quite a bit of talk, and we had some pretty spirited debate about federal dollars coming in, starting a program, disappearing, and then the state on the hook. And so I guess I'm just curious, you know, you made the statement, when we look back 10 years, we'll be able to see, why is this program different?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not so sure. Is the question, will there be carrying costs beyond what has been made available by the federal government to...
Correct, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't see a sunset in this. And so I'm assuming that this will be an ongoing program once we stand it up with the federal ARPA dollars. I'm assuming that those are ARPA dollars, those are OTO from the feds. I guess unless there is another ARPA coming, or there's more federal money available, will there be a state requirement for the continuation of this program in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynch, I think that to the extent that there are going to be ongoing costs, that'll be up to a future legislature to assess whether the utility of the project is something that merits our continued use and appropriation. And I guess in that respect, I don't think it's any different than any other procurement that we undertake. If we decide that there isn't value, we can abandon it.
And one other question. I know that kind of the philosophy has changed with regards to the way IT is constructed or, you know, is procured within the state. And, you know, MMIS was, we took the whole elephant in one bite. And I've heard it referred to, you're better to have a lot of small wins and get, you know, people in the system, using the system, have small successes, lessons learned and build from that. And so I guess I'm just curious if it's more appropriate, even, you know, when we look at page one where you pointed out we were talking about school districts. Now we've cast the net wider to the university system as well. And I'm just curious, does it make sense, or were there conversations about starting with a pilot program and standing up, you know, three or five school districts and maybe a two-year college and a four-year college? Or is it, are we going to take the elephant with one big bite?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, I think it's a fair question, but my answer is this is not MMIS, right? I mean, MMIS was something that was everything from claims processing to quality assurance. There was a breadth of everything that was trying to be done as part of MMIS that I think, particularly when we didn't have something that had been implemented and utilized across the board in, you know, multiple other states, we were at a significant disadvantage in terms of everything that MMIS was supposed to achieve. I think we're in a very different position here, and as the director said, the scoping that they've done in terms of just potential vendors who have already done this sort of thing for other states, I just think we should have a much greater confidence level that we can get a product that's going to achieve what we want based upon what's already out there in a way that, you know, easier certainly to sit here now than it would have been in 2009. But MMIS is just, I can see why there's an argument now that it should have been done in a more modular fashion. I don't think this is analogous.
Further questions, Senator Solomon?
Mr. Chairman, can I have Representative Beattie?
Representative Beattie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beattie, without getting in the weeds, why do we want this data and what are we going to do with it?
Chairman Esp and Senator Solomon, first of all, much of this data already is being collected in one way or another from the schools and that sort of thing. And so as I approach your question, I want to also address some concerns that Senator Lynch had as well. I don't think it's accurate to characterize this as a new sort of system or a new sort of data enterprise with respect to data. This is a replacement of a cobbled together system that has proven to be ineffective and difficult to manage, and so that any O&M that's associated with that, we're already bearing those costs right now. Fair question about how that works out in the future, but as the bill indicated, there's a requirement that costing out O&M be addressed as well. With respect to the use of this data, I think it can be used in a multitude of different ways. Clearly, the K-12 systems already supply data to the OPI. We want to make sure that that particular conduit is smooth and is not burdensome for our K-12 districts across the state. I think that the most general statement I can say about what we're going to use this data for is to allow us to assess within the K-12 system, is to allow us to better assess the effectiveness of programs we put together, for instance, transformational learning programs, advanced opportunity programs, which we have specifically funded outside of K-12 base aid with an expectation that certain outcomes are achieved. This sort of a data system will facilitate us getting the answers we need, because there's no point in starting programs up that we find later on are not effective. So I think it should assist us as a legislature who appropriates dollars for certain educational purposes to see whether we're getting the bang for the buck. As Representative Mercer pointed out, I share his interest in seeing how well prepared our K-12 students are, either for college or for the workforce or for continuing training in the current technical education arena. We think that having this sort of data available will allow us to pose questions and get answers so we can judge the effectiveness of our K-12 education. And furthermore, I think help our higher education and current technical education activities across the state better define what it better identify what's coming their way and be able to communicate back to our K-12 system where deficiencies are, not in general platitudes sorts of ways, but to be able to specifically identify areas that need to be addressed and to be able to, in a sense, quantify that. That's the expectation of having a data modernization system. Collecting data for the purpose of collecting data, well, I guess it might help you with some federal reporting requirements, but it would be largely a waste of money.
Thank you. Before I go to Senator Lang, Mr. Phillips, did you have a question? Or I see you're standing. I imagine it's not for your exercise.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so I just want to address the Senator's question, too, about ongoing cost of the database modernization project. And so, like with any IT system, OPI absolutely will have incurred what they call maintenance agreements with the vendors. And so during the legislature, we'll have to come back for the next biennium and actually ask for appropriation for that. With the funding itself, I just want to clarify as well is that there's two pots of money that we're talking about. First, you have the first one was in House Bill 630. That was $8 million set aside. Of that, we've actually expended, like Representative Beattie had stated, just a little over $1 million. We have $3 million of that also committed through current contracts that have already been approved. So there's a portion of that that we have to actually have obligated by September 30th of this year. But that doesn't mean that the funds have to be fully liquidated. We also have a liquidation period to actually spend those funds down and have it served. And so there's also that remaining $5 million that actually goes out till September of 24. And so timing is really just that first portion is where there's that more critical point. But I did want to make sure we address that there will be ongoing maintenance costs as well. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Senator Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Mr. Phillips, please. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Phillips, as I sit here, I see kind of a four-legged stool. We have this bill, Department of Administration, we have the ARPA funds, and we have OPI. And you're a big decision maker, and sitting on top of the stool is our students and the data that we want to collect or have collected. So how do you see the integration in, it sounds like from your previous statements here a minute ago, you have spent some money, but will this bill help you give us a better product to collect data about our students and how our education system will function in the state down the road?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lang, so I think it's been represented here is that the data that we're collecting is not going to change due to this bill. So we're still going to continue to collect the same type of data and report that to the feds. What it will do, I think, and that the intention of the bill is to provide that the mechanism for actually collecting the information and absolutely making it available to our other educational partners. Again, but we're not talking about changing our actual data requests at this point.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative, would you care to close on your bill?
I close, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for good hearing.
Let's close the hearing on House Bill 367. As the room clears out, we'll allow the sponsor to make his way to the podium. And we will open the hearing on Senate Bill 104. Senator Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Senator John Fuller, Senate District 4, which is Kalispell. I bring to you today Senate Bill 104. The short title, of course, is obvious, but we're speaking to the fiscal note. And naturally, I'm very cognizant of the fact that the three people that voted against this bill on the floor are sitting on this committee, so I'm confident in my eloquence and reasoning, and especially through my proponent's assistance, that we will be able to convince you that this is exactly what I have claimed it to be, a workforce development program that will result in increased revenue for the state of Montana, an improvement in the quality of life for Montanans, and good for all Montanans by encouraging retired military service personnel to come return home to Montana. Now, first, a real definition. Remember, there are veterans and then there are retired military service personnel. Retired military service personnel are veterans. But veterans, not necessarily, you know, retired military. And so we all know that the fiscal note is static. That's what we're stuck with. There's significant evidence that indicates that each new military retiree brings significant increases in revenue to the state after, if not 2 years, by 3 years. Okay, they bring their pensions, their new businesses, their families' incomes, their corporate wealth or estimate. So I estimate that the impact of this fiscal note has been inflated by 30% initially. And that the results will be within a short period of time. I would point out also that there is a sunset on this after 10 years, and by the year 2033, that legislature should be able to ascertain if the increase of retired military service personnel's has occurred, which is what this is designed to do. We know there are slightly less than 8,000 here in Montana now. And if that has occurred, then they can continue the program. So I will sit down and let proponents who are more eloquent and knowledgeable than me take the stand. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Proponents of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roger Hagan. Last name spelled H-A-G-A-N, and I represent the more than 10,000 members of the Montana Department of the American Legion and the several thousand members currently serving and previously served with the Montana National Guard officer and enlisted associations. In full disclosure to the committee, if this bill were to pass, me being a 38-year Air Force Air National Guard veteran, my benefits would be very minimal because my income for Montana source wage income is very minimal. And if my principals understand that I was serious when I said this is my last session of lobbying for their representation, my minimum income will go to zero starting in tax year 24. So with that, I do not stand to benefit any, if anything, for this bill. What this bill is economic and workforce development. You've heard that. The fiscal note does not necessarily reflect the benefits of enticing good young retirees, young compared to my age, 39 to 43-year-old members who have completed their military careers and are off to start either a new business or a new career and continue to be productive in the state of Montana. And this bill would invite them to be there. The fiscal note, like I said, does not reflect that. We have an aging workforce, and the workforce we do have is short of employees, and we need to entice more people to come to Montana to fill that workforce void. So this gives us a return on investment in this bill. And even though the fiscal note, as we said, does not reflect that, there have been studies done by several states and then the states that have passed tax exemption for military retirement, it has borne out that they, in fact, have brought more income and revenue source into their state once they pass the bill. Even California has a study that says that they would benefit if they were to tax exempt military retirement. So what this bill is not is a thank you for your service. This bill is not something that I would ask you to look at. Don't look at it as a thank you, a veteran, for your service. And as the sponsor indicated, there's just shy of 8,000 who are actually retired military veterans. So the process of relocation for a newly or future to retire military member.
Mr. Hagan, we're kind of getting off the fiscal note here.
I think it all focuses to the economic impact, but I'll respect that, sir.
Right.
The sunset, to me, does not add to the benefit of the bill. In fact, I think it detracts from the bill, and I think it would detract from the amount of people who would come to Montana or considering come to Montana financially. And, sir, with your permission, I have a statement from another veteran that I would like to read in. It's very brief, if I may.
As long as it pertains to the fiscal note in some way.
Committee has an opportunity to impact the future of Montana by passing this bill. Military retirees spend upwards of a year weighing the pros and cons of where to retire, and state tax in Montana is a big con for military retirees. Montanans need the 40-year-old retiree. They bring pension, entrepreneurship, and a sense of community involvement with them upon retirement. Changing the tax code will make Montana more appealing to a highly successful, motivated future Montana. This will not impact Montana fiscally in a negative way if you consider that a military retiree brings money into the state with a federal pension. And most will seek employment in Montana that what retiree will have to pay state taxes on. I urge your support. Dwayne Cunningham, Montana Department of American Legion, Department Adjutant. With that, I urge your support of 104, and I urge you to remove the tenure limitation. Thank you.
Mr. Hagan, could you make that statement available to staff for the record, please? For the proponents. And remember, we're trying to talk about the fiscal impact, yes. The fiscal note.
Yes, Chairman. My name is Jeff Shep. Last name is S-C-H-E-P-P. I'm the state commander for the VFW Veterans of Foreign Wars. I am here in support of the bill. I do also represent more than 10,000 combat veterans throughout the United, throughout the state of Montana. With full support of all the members, the only concern we have is the sunset. We ask that the sunset be removed. This is something that, as Mr. Hagan had mentioned too, this will bring veterans to the state of Montana. I have friends that I'm a 29-year combat veteran, retired from the military in September of 21, and I currently lived in Montana, but I know friends of mine that are the same age and are contemplating moving to Montana, but one of the deterrents would be hoping that they would receive benefits on their income tax. So again, the VFW is in support of the bill, but would like to see the sunset removed. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Further proponents? Mr. Gault.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Gault, and I'm here on behalf of the Montana Chamber of Commerce, and we want to lend our support to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gault. Further proponents?
Good morning. My name is Bill White. Last name is spelled W-H-I-T-E. I'm American Legion representative to the governor. And in our meetings, we have discussed this bill, and so we are asking that it be a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Further proponents?
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Allison Corbin, last name C-O-R-B-Y-N, representing Big Sky Economic Development, the economic development organization that serves Yellowstone County, along with Montana Economic Developers Association, which covers economic development, organizations throughout the state of Montana. I'm here to talk a little bit about the value of these veterans coming to our state from a fiscal standpoint. We do know that about 36,000 career veterans exit the military, so they're retiring. They're between the ages of 40 and 50. And we know that veterans are 45% more likely to start their own business. So when these folks exit the military, we want them to come to the state of Montana. And as we know, we don't deliver dynamic fiscal notes here. And I can provide you example after example of veterans that we came in contact with at Big Sky Economic Development. We host the Veteran Business Outreach Center for a multi-state region. We consistently host boots to business classes on military bases, which are helping with the transition period. So when military veterans are preparing to leave the military, they go through these classes called Boots to Business. And so consistently we interact with military folks that are about to retire, that are interested in starting their businesses, that then look at the financial implications of choosing to be in Montana and go elsewhere, since we are one of the few states left that fully tax veteran retirement and their pensions. And so I think that there's a significant opportunity to attract veterans for both our workforce with significant leadership experience and skills they've gained in their at least 20-year career, and also come to Montana to start businesses. So we urge due pass and also suggest the removal of the 10-year sunset, because if they're making the choice to come to Montana, we don't want to tell them that in 10 years we'll begin taxing your pension again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Further proponents? Further proponents in the room? Seeing none. Is there a proponent online? Looks like there is.
Mr. Chair, it does appear like there is one proponent on Senate Bill 104. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. State your name.
Good morning, Chairman S. This is Shane Etzweiler. Last name is spelled E-T-Z-W-I-L-E-R. And I am speaking on behalf of the Great Falls Area Chamber of Commerce and a couple of other organizations as well, too. Underneath our chamber umbrella, we also have our Military Affairs Committee, as well as our Montana Defense Alliance Committee as well, too. So we work closely with our military partners, the Montana Air National Guard and the Malmstrom Air Force Base. I do want to speak towards workforce opportunities and the economic impact with this bill. And again, we're speaking in favor of it and support of it. Just attended yesterday the Montana Chamber Manufacturing and International Trade Day, and the number one topic was, we need workers, we need workforce. Military personnel who retire, they're looking to start their second career. And what a perfect fit for our military partners in the manufacturing sector. They're used to project management, they're used to flow of work, they're used to operations. They are a perfect fit for our manufacturing sector. The economic impact, as was mentioned earlier by Mr. Hagan, these folks retire in their 40s, mid-40s, early 50s. They're ready to start their second career. They will find another job, and typically these are middle to higher paying jobs that they will find. Their spouse, who's kind of put their career on hold for many years following their military partner through all the moves that they have done, they're ready to start their second career as well, which is typically a middle to higher paying wage job. We will earn taxes on their money from these second careers. They usually bring high school students.
So, Mr. Etzweiler,
well, which also find jobs in our community.
Mr. Etzweiler, sir,
pay property taxes.
Sir, we're only going to talk about the fiscal impact. This bill's had a full hearing and heard all the things you've said. It passed the floor 47-3. So, if you have something specific to say about the fiscal impact or the fiscal note on the bill, that'd be great. But the bill has had a full hearing somewhere else.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And just want to reiterate what the other folks have mentioned as well, too, just the positive impact to workforce. It will bring more income taxes and revenue to our state. And again, I was asked by the Montana Chamber, Charles Robinson, as well as the Billing Chamber, Dan Rooks, to let the committee know that they also are in support of this bill. Thank you for your time, sir.
You betcha. For the proponents online, seeing none, opponents in the room.
Good morning, Chairman Esp, members of the committee. Rose Bender, B-E-N-D-E-R, representing Montana Budget and Policy Center. First, I would like to express our appreciation and thanks to those who have served our country. Montana Budget and Policy Center respectfully opposes Senate Bill 104. Montana law already has tax exemptions for retirees or those over 65 and exempt salaries of those on active duty in regular armed forces and National Guard. As shown in the fiscal note, this bill does have a fiscal impact that will impact our state in the next fiscal year, increasing over time. Montana Budget and Policy Center is also very interested in the tax incidence in Montana, or who is actually paying our state and local taxes. Montana does have a slightly regressive system at this point, which means that those living on lower incomes pay a larger share of their incomes in state and local taxes than the wealthy. Bills like this that are not targeted to lower-income households further this problem. If the legislature was to decide to exempt military retirement from income tax, we would recommend the legislature consider limiting the exemption to households with lower incomes. Additionally, the Department of Revenue looked at migration patterns following the significant 2003 income tax cuts passed by the Montana legislature and could not identify any change in migration due to those large income tax cuts. If there is interest in addressing our workforce issues, putting these same dollars towards childcare and affordable
Again,
housing Ms. solutions.
Bender, we're, it's the same story.
Thank you.
Different witness. Thank you. Any further opponents? Further opponents, informational witnesses.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron McNay, MCNAY, and I'm with the Montana Department of Revenue. I'll be happy to try and answer questions with regards to the fiscal note.
Thank you. Further informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee. Senator McGilvray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the sponsor.
Senator Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGilvray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking at the fiscal note on the assumptions and on number two. I would like you to explain to me why you put that amendment in there to make the choice of Montana source income or the military pension deduction. What's the logic of adding the Montana source income as an option?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm sorry, but I have sacrificed my hearing in the service of my country, and I missed the last half of your question.
All right, let me try again. Mr. Chair, Senator, what's the logic of adding the Montana source income as an option, as a deduction, if it's less than the lesser of the two?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Senator. Thanks for the question. The option here, the reality here is that we have basically two kinds of military retirees that are going to be coming to Montana, enlisted personnel and military personnel, and officers. And officers, their military pension is going to be significantly greater than the enlisted personnel. And so it was felt, and I give credit to this amendment to Senator Hertz in the Tax Committee, that it was felt that the purpose of the bill is to encourage people to come here and get jobs and contribute to the Montana economy. Consequently, then, the Montana source wage income whichever is less, if your pension is less, and for instance, an enlisted personnel coming here, say he is a E8 or an E9, and he comes here and then he starts a successful business, he's going to be paying taxes on his business, and if his income from his pension is less, then he gets to exempt 50% of that than it would be on his income. But if he comes here and takes a job as a teacher and is relegated to the early status, then whichever is less, then he gets to exempt that. Does that make sense, sir?
No.
No.
That's okay. It's. I can talk to you offline on that.
Yeah, and we can talk about it in executive, too. Senator Cuff.
Well, I had a similar question, Mr. Chairman, and for the sponsor. Number one, are they paying taxes or are they exempt from paying taxes only on their retirement money? But if they take a second job, no matter who they're working for, do they pay taxes on the income that's earned in Montana after they're retired from the military?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cuff. Okay. The Senate, the bill as it sits, exempts the lesser of 50% of military retirement pay or the Montana source wage income. Okay, the lesser. So if someone comes here and their pension is larger than the second job, then they exempt 50% of their Montana wage income. If they come here and they make a successful job where they're making more than their income, and for an enlisted personnel, that wouldn't be that difficult, then they exempt 50% of their military pension. Did I?
I think that helps, Mr. Chairman. Does this not apply to veterans who have served a 2 to 4 year term and came home and then continued working?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cobb, this replies only to military retirees. Now, normally at this point, normally that is 20 years. My understanding is that the current restructuring of the military pension, many military, since we've been professional for many years, a lot of subsequent retirees are going to be retiring with less than 20-year pensions, and they'll have annuities that will be significantly less than the pensions of 20-year veterans. But right now, I would venture to say that there are no military retirees that it's going to affect.
And one last one, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cuff.
Do these normally, when they come out after 20 years, do they begin pulling that retirement immediately, or do they have to wait until they hit a certain age?
Good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question. The answer is they normally begin pulling their retirement pension after their 20-year retirement.
Thank you very much.
I have a question for the man from the Department of Revenue. Mr. Lickney, I just want you to confirm or at least let the committee know what that section of the bill that was amended in does. Does it do exactly what the sponsor says, or is there another way to look at it?
Chairman, I do believe for the most part that the sponsor was correct in describing it. So what would occur is right now that military retirement income would be included in their federal taxable income. Those taxpayers would then take that income they received for their military pension. They would multiply that by 50% to get that 50% amount. Then the taxpayers would take their Montana source wage income, as it's defined here. They would take their Montana wage income, any business income, and then they would estimate that. And then they would look at those two numbers, that 50% of retirement income, their Montana source wage income, and then they would say, okay, which of these two is smaller? If it's that 50% of retirement income, that's what they would subtract out of their Montana taxable income. If it's the Montana source wage income amount that's smaller, they would subtract that out from their Montana taxable income.
Yeah. Thank you. That's how I read the bill, too. Any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Fuller, would you care to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for a good hearing. I just want to point out one thing. Remember that this fiscal note is not spending a dime. It's a reduction in revenue if this benefit is given to those who decide to retire. Secondly, I would like to remember that military retirees can go anywhere in the country. We want them to come here to Montana and contribute to the Montana economy. I thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for a good hearing.
Thank you, Senator Fuller, and thank you for all that came. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 104. We will now open the hearing on Senate Bill 402. Senator Curdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Willis Curdy, C-U-R-D-Y, represent Senate District 49. Hutch goes from Lolo Pass down through Lolo Canyon to the Bitter River, west side of the river, include the Target Range, Orchard Homes, Fort Missoula areas, and Mullen Road, and all the way out to Alberton and back to Lolo Pass. I bring to you today Senate Bill 402, which provides 25% differential pay for work on an uncontrolled fire and work under hovering helicopters at established helibase. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, of course, you all have heard this bill in committee. I just want to take a minute and go to the fiscal note under assumptions. I want to make sure this is clear. Item number one, it says that it's assumed the balance of the fire suppression fund and related statutory appropriation is sufficient to provide revenues to provide sufficient to cover the estimated expenses described in the fiscal note. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, one of the things that really prompted me to sponsor this bill is that we are, the state of Montana, and this is not exclusive to the state, but to states around the West, is the scramble for firefighters. Last year, about this time, the state of Idaho, Governor Brad Little signed a bill creating hazard pay for Idaho Department of State Lands firefighters. They recognized that they needed to keep, they needed to retain, they needed to train their firefighters to a level that they would be effective, safe in their job. So that prompted me, not exclusively, but it helped prompt me to move forward in sponsorship of this bill. And I didn't mention this during our floor session, but this bill pretty much mimics the Idaho Department of State Lands bill that protects their wildland firefighters. So again, here in Montana, we are likewise facing an issue about retaining our firefighters. And the previous director of the Department of State Lands, or not State Lands, but the fire director, Sonia Gurman, mentioned in our presentation to our Environmental Quality Council that state of Montana is having a difficult time filling all of its positions. We run 200 plus engines around the state with our cooperators, and I know in 2021 it was a scramble to make sure we could fill all those positions. So again, my effort here, I know the cost is estimated cost of $585,000 per year, but that is a small portion of what we need to keep and retain our firefighters. So again, this bill is there to help just do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Are there proponents in the room for Senate Bill 402? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair, Committee. My name is Tanner Motzel, M-A-C-A-L. I'm a wildland firefighter and now with the Forest Service. Used to be with the state for 3 years. This bill would help, simply put, help keep and retain firefighters. One of the reasons I left the state agency was because of pay. That 25% bump helps out. I know I looked back through records. I worked May through October, my first year on fire, made $18,000. Last year with the feds, I made $41,000. that right there is going to be a huge reason for retention and retaining. And experience is a big thing, not only for entry-level positions, but as you move through fire and you have incident commanders. Again, that's a huge proponent for retaining and retention. Another part is it's earned. Hazards are a part of the job. A 25% bump is a way to give people what they've earned. I know I've had friends who have passed away in this job while on duty. I know I've experienced close calls in my own fire career. Hazards, just name a few, uncontrolled fire line, snags, helicopters, bucket drops. The hazard pay goes a lot to making us feel like we're wanted. And also mental health. It's good to know when your agency respects, sorry, if you can tell I'm nervous, I don't do this very often. This is the first time, so I apologize.
No troubles.
Again, mental health as well. It makes you feel valued as a personnel when you have a pay bump, and it makes you want to work harder for the agency or the your employer when you feel valued. This would help with that. I know there's a lot of my friends that are still with the state, as well as people I've talked to, where this is a big thing that they want done, and I want to thank the sponsor for bringing it forward. It's listening to firefighters' voices. And I'll just finish up with saying I hope that this bill goes forward, and thank you all for giving me the time to talk.
Thank you, Mr. Markle, for the proponents. Welcome.
Chairman, members of the committee, Sam Forstag, F-O-R-S-T-A-G, here today on behalf of myself. When I'm not up here at the legislature, my day job is working wildland fire. I'm a federal employee. I'm with the U.S. Forest Service. But when I began my career, I was with the Lincoln Ranger District on the Helena National Forest, and a common practice, I assume still, for those districts is to put together something informally called a throw-together crew. That's a crew with state DNRC folks, with Forest Service, BLM. It's an interagency collaboration that helps with folks gaining experience. It helps folks to get out on fires and see what it's like working on the fire line so that they're ready when we have a big fire season like we saw in 2021 and 2017. And when we're on that 21-man hand crew with DNRC and feds, the moment you get engaged, every federal employee is receiving a 25% bump, and every DNRC firefighter is not. That's an absurd result. That's something that, as the previous proponent noted, I saw in my work having an impact on the morale of certain folks, and it's not what we should be asking of our state firefighters when they're doing the exact same job as the federal firefighters who are out on the fire line. In terms of hazard pay, which is what is in question with this bill, I would just echo those previous sentiments. I think anyone who does this job long enough will see what the actual hazards of this job are, no matter what you do to mitigate those risks. I had a young man who worked for me for about 3 years up north of Sealy Lake just last season. He was out snagging ahead of his crew and dropped a tree exactly where he was asked to, and that tree falling triggered another tree falling behind him, and he's no longer alive. 1 week later, a state employee there in Oregon also died on a fire in Oregon. I believe they receive hazard pay for their work. There's no reason that Montana state firefighters should not as well, because their work is just as hazardous as ours. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forstag. Further proponents? Further proponents? Are there proponents online? Katya.
Mr. Chair, there is nobody online to testify on this bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any opponents in the room? Opponents? Seeing none, informational witnesses.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wyatt Frampton. That's spelled F-R-A-M-P-T-O-N. And I am the Deputy Administrator for the Forestry Division of the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. Here to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Further informational witnesses. Seeing none, questions from the committee. Senator Cuff.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe it was Mr. Mackel who had worked for the state and then later the
Mr. Mokel, yes.
Yeah, thank you. It's don't worry about it. It's Motzel, M-A-C-A-L.
Okay,
don't,
sorry.
You're good.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mockel, you had mentioned, I believe it was $18,000 for May through October.
Yeah.
And 41 then. Was that for the same amount of time?
About the same. I'd say there was more hours for overtime. There was that. But H-Pay definitely factors in a big proponent because every hour I'm making 25% more than I did with the state. Okay. So I'd say a huge factor was H-Pay and then a little bit more time worked just because the state agency, the firefighters are a state resource, so they stay home a little more. Working for the federal service, I went out of state more, went on a little bit more assignments, but I'd say a huge part of that was H-Pay.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mr. Mockel, just a couple more.
Yes, sir.
When you said you worked for $18,000, how long ago was that?
That would be 2018. That was my first year in fire.
Okay. And in your time on the state in that situation, were there times when you would have been working that you wouldn't have considered it hazardous?
I'd say base hours, sitting around where you're waiting for a fire call, when you're doing just, you know, PT, that sort of thing. I would say that probably wouldn't qualify for H-Pay, but chainsaw operations, working with helicopters, working on uncontrolled fire line, I'd even argue prescribed burns for the simple fact that I've choked more smoke on prescribed burns than I do on regular wildfire operations. There's a thing called holding. Usually that'll be with the wind direction. And some of those times it's fuel moisture, you have more smoke. I've had times where you got to take a break, step out of line and, you know, hack. That's the best way to put it. Get yourself some fresh air. So I'd see even prescribed burning, chainsaw operations, any sort of uncontrolled fire line, that would all be, I'd consider hazardous myself.
So, Mr. Mocco, when you're working for the feds, is there any time that your pay is not bumped with the hazard?
I'm so sorry. I heard a cough, so I'm going to need you to repeat that.
So when you're working on your job currently, is there any time that you do not get hazard pay?
That is correct. Base hours, waiting for another fire call. It would be the same. And then also, we don't get on prescribed burning. Currently, I know I've heard that that's in the works. That would be a preemptive thing. I think it should be done, and that'd be the sentiment for most wildland firefighters, state and federal, for what I just said, where there's still the mitigation of you're having fire on the ground. I mean, I've been on prescribed burns where they've escaped, and you have to catch them.
All righty. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
For the question, Senator McGilvray.
For Mr. Mockel, can you just tell us what the base pay for a firefighter is, like an hourly wage?
So I looked. Mine in 2018 for starting out was $13.99, I believe is what it was.
Okay.
With the feds, I started with as a GS3. I was a GS4 the last two seasons. I started as a GS4, I'm sorry, with the feds, which is a little higher, and I believe it's in that 14 or so range, somewhere in there. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. I know that number is available if you look it up, though. And also, I should mention, I'm just representing myself today. I'm not representing anybody else.
Thank you. Just so follow-up. So those base, and you may not know this, maybe I could defer to somebody else, maybe the sponsor. Maybe I'll just defer this to the sponsor, if that's okay.
Okay. But Senator Curdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator McGilvray.
Yeah, Senator Curdy, I'm curious if you can just tell us what the base pay for the DNRC firefighters are now.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGilvray, I think the governor a couple years ago gave a bump about $1.70 an hour. So I think they're somewhere around, maybe Mr. Frampton would be a better, give us a better answer.
Okay, whoever can answer the question, that's all I care about.
Mr. Frampton, would you like to come to the podium?
Mr. Chair, Senator, currently entry-level wildland fire positions with the DNRC are about $16. In 2021, the governor authorized a pay increase of $1.70 for the base wage of those entry-level positions.
So it's 22? Did you? I lost you again with a cough or something, but So what is the base pay right now?
Currently, the base pay is $16, approximately. I think it's $16.07 for entry-level positions.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Frampton, at the end of the biennium, under House Bill 13, what will that rate be?
I'm not familiar with what the increase for those positions will be if House Bill 13 passes.
All righty. Thank you. Well, it's well on its way. Senator Flowers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Flowers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Curdy, one of the things that's not really addressed in the fiscal note, which is typical, is cost of training. And the way it's relevant for this particular bill is I think wage affects turnover rate. And I assume it costs more to train than retrain somebody who's coming back. So could you talk about what the turnover rate is for state firefighters and if you know what that is relative to federal?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Flowers, I will answer part of that question, and then I'm going to have to ask Mr. Frampton because he has better data. But usually for a new firefighter, you're looking at that's a minimum of 2 weeks to 4 weeks of training. The training is extensive. There's as a beginning firefighter, you have to go through a whole regimen of what is called S courses and I courses, which give you basic fire weather, basic hand tool use. There's use of chainsaw use. Firefighter overhead, so you know command structure, and then going out into the field, practicing digging hand line, using pumps, pumpers, fire line hose, and of course, along with that comes work around helicopters. The state of Montana runs, I think we still have four what is called MT-206s helicopters. And so they're trained on ingress and egress from helicopters, hooking up long lines under the helicopter. And, of course, they will go out and start a practice fire and, again, use all of that during that period of time. For a refreshing firefighter, for somebody who is coming back, basically what they have to do is go back through what is mandated by the National Wildfire Coordinating Group, and that is usually a week to week and a half training. And the other part in terms of turnover rate, I'd have to refer to Mr. Frampton. He might have the answer for that.
Thank you. Mr. Frampton, would you care to take a crack at that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, so to my understanding is the question pertains to what is the typical turnover rate for us and how much time or effort is expended for training. Is that correct? So typically with our entry-level fire positions, we see around a depending on the location, 50 to 80% turnover. And as someone stays in the system or they develop more experience, that rate of turnover decreases as they move into higher paying or longer term positions. In terms of training for a brand new seasonal employee, we typically expend approximately 120 hours of training to bring them up to standard. And this can cost, depending on the location and the number of new employees that year, between $5,000 to $10,000 per employee as a rough ballpark.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. So would you expect turnover rate to decline if, in other words, retain employees longer with this hazard pay as opposed to losing them to sister federal agencies and therefore reduce training costs in the process?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think as if we are able to increase the benefits or opportunities to our employees, that will help with retention. It is a competitive job market. We're seeing a reduction in the number of applications we have for firefighters this year.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Pope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Frampton. Getting your exercise this morning, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Frampton, I just wanted to follow up on some of the earlier conversation. Could you clarify again? I think it was already said, but just how many firefighters are in the department?
Mr. Chair, Senator, so the department we have, I'd call our tip of the spear or bulk of our firefighters, we have approximately 150 seasonal or guaranteed seasonal positions.
Mm-hmm. And would you have a sense of what the personal wages, you know, line item would be for the department for labor? I'm talking about the firefighters, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we'd be happy to provide you a breakout of what the individual pay rates for the positions are, but the entry level starts at, for our seasonal positions, starts at 16, and then okay. As they progress through the ranks, it's in the $21-$22 an hour for like a senior engine boss position.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Pope.
I'm not sure if Mr. Frampton can answer this one, but would you have a sense of, in ballpark, you know, how much are we spending on firefighting? I realize each year is different, but what's a starting point on that conversation?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator. So in the fiscal note, we in our assumptions, we over the last 10 years, we estimate that on average we spend around $26 million per fire season.
Have you done a calculation, Mr. Chair? One last follow-up. What is the if we're spending $500,000, say $600,000 on a $26 million budget? I can do the math, but yep. Thank you.
I'll bet you can. Further questions, Senator Lenz.
For Mr. Frampton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, two questions. One's on the technical notes in the. And the fiscal note. Under item one, delineating different timekeeping requirements or salary codes for suppression efforts would likely be difficult for DNRC since this is during uncontrolled fire. And under four, on line one and two, it would be extremely difficult to assign separate pay rates for certain hours or minutes of the day when they're working on the fire line. Could you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. Mr. Chair, Senator, so when we were doing this analysis, our current financial system didn't make it easy to pull this information out. So how we were looking at that is if we did implement this at present, how would we go about doing that? Looking at what a few other states have done is rather than trying to delineate the hour that the hour in the day that the hazard pay started, they opted to just pay hazard pay for that entire shift. So if someone 6 hours into their shift got assigned or responded to a fire that was uncontrolled, they would then qualify for hazard pay for the entire shift that they were working.
So that follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So that was, and that's mentioned in item two, that would be your response to solving that problem. Thank you. Final question, Mr. Chair. We have 150 seasonal, but that isn't the only firefighters we have available, you know, in DNRC. There's people that then go on to the fire line. How many more do we have available, current full-time employees?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator, so current available to, in an all-hands-on-deck situation, we have several hundred within the agency who their primary job is not fire response. They have a day job, whether it's a forester or some other administrative function, but in severe fire seasons, they can be called in to assist. The DNRC also, depending on the severity of the season, has tools available to us to ramp up by bringing on additional forces through agreements with volunteer fire departments or other contract entities.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. One quick question, and I'll be done. Within that group, give me a wage, hourly wage range.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think it'd be very difficult to give a range. I mean, you're talking potentially a significant portion of the agency, but I will say the vast majority of fire suppression done by our organization is at those entry-level firefighter or engine boss positions.
So the several hundred are still at the entry level? You mentioned the 150 seasonal, but the several hundred others are still at entry level?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator. So when we call in additional resources who have a different day job, they're paid their day job rate to participate in the suppression activity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, those might be the ones that are out there holding meetings and figuring out what everybody else is going to do. Little else. Senator Majot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for, I guess we could start with the sponsor and see if he knows the answer. And while he's coming up, I do want to say, you know, I think Mr. Forstag is a very humble guy. He jumps out of airplanes for us on fires as a smoke jumper. So I think his job's pretty hazardous in that regard. So thank you for all your work, Mr. Forstag. Mr. Chair, Senator Curdy, my question is just, you know, as we see states around us, you know, fire seasons often being extended, I guess my worry, too, is that we lose firefighters to states around us, you know. And I was just curious if you could talk to any statistics or data on what other states might be doing on this front.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. So, two years ago, the state of California bumped their pay considerably. It was like about a 40% pay. That resulted in one-third of all the U.S. Forest Service employees, fire employees in California, leaving the Forest Service and go to work for CAL FIRE. The state of Idaho, as I point out, when they passed their bill, they're realizing they're losing 40 to 50% of their employees to the Forest Service is paying higher wage and, of course, paying hazard pay. So, again, we all know in this economy that rounding up employees can be difficult. And for the pay that's being offered, it can be difficult. And one last thing is that this year, the federal wildland fire community got, every firefighter got a 50% increase in their base pay in order to retain these folks. Now, I know the state of Montana can't compete with the feds all the way down the line. There's no way. But again, you know, this is just a small effort to try to boost morale and at least keep us in the game. So there's where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? I'm rapidly losing control of the fiscal note discussion here. Senator Cuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question for the sponsor is simply, why are we seeing this bill here? There's no one here from DNRC. There's no one here from a collective bargaining unit as an informational witness. I'm sorry, I should have said there's no proponents here from DNRC and no proponents from the collective bargaining unit. And why are we addressing it now legislatively?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cuff, so I've spoken with the department and I think as normal, when we have revenue bills like this or spending bills like this, a lot of times there have been given direction to stand down. So I've discussed this with the lieutenant governor twice and with Mike Freeman, the governor's natural resources policy director, twice. So I've had the discussions. So that's the best answer I can give. Okay.
Senator Flowers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Senator Len's line of questioning there, for the sponsor.
Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Flowers.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Curdy, I've worked on the kind of the professional end of this myself, not as a professional firefighter, but as a forester who was called into service, so to speak. And I think it's true that there are a group of foresters, for example, who are called out on fires, but typically those folks are working as part of the incident command structure. So they're, you know, in the planning section or the ops section or whatever. So they would not qualify for this hazard pay. There are some exceptions that go actually work on the line, and they would be, you know, they would have this bump available to them. But those are typically entry-level foresters, and so they're not the higher wage sort of professional foresters.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Flowers, so I'm going to give you, as is said in the bill and in the fiscal note, I mean, this applies only people who are actually on the line on a uncontrolled fire. Now, if you read the fiscal note is pretty clear in saying that a good share of the fires are taken care of within a first burning period or first day of suppression. Okay? 1% of the fires generally escape initial attack and result in anywhere from a 3 to maybe, well, unfortunately, in some cases, in the most extreme cases, you might have a full month or 5-week to 6-week campaign. And it is a campaign. So, but again, this is only for those folks who are actually out there on the fire line with tool in hand digging fire line, or they're working on that under that helicopter. Now, my experience is that when I was flying, doing my thing, I didn't get hazard pay. I was on several Type 1 teams from Alaska to the Southwest, and being in plans and the like, I didn't get hazard pay because I wasn't out there on the line, again, with tool in hand, building fire line, sawing down snags, dodging rolling rocks, and the like. That's why hazard pay is there.
Seeing no...
Mr. Chair.
One more question, Vice Chair Hills.
Thank you for the sponsor. There's a couple technical notes on some of the definitions, and I wondered if you would be receptive to... I assume that first technical note indicates there's a difference. The term used in this bill restricts this benefit to forest land fires. And I assume grassland fires is what you would consider also, so we would need to change the definition to just wildfire. Is that acceptable?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Ellis, you're correct. I mean... So wildland fires occur in basically forested regimens and also grasslands. And the state of Montana, since we have responsibility for protection of private property, that also includes a lot of times private property like a farmer's pasture or even their barley crop or grain crop.
Yeah,
because I've had to go out and personally work saving somebody's grain crop.
So what I'm hearing is you're okay with changing that definition so that it's the one that would include grassland fires. And then the second technical note just has another definitional change where you just use the term, what they recommend you do is use the term firefighter. I think Senator Lenz's lines of question said that if that definition change was taken care of, then technical note 4 disappears too. And so I just wanted to see what you thought about a couple small amendments to the bill.
I mean, Senator Ellis, Mr. Chair, Senator Ellis, your pleasure. I'd have to go to Mr. Frampton to see why they wrote the language here that they did.
Okay.
So I can't go into the specifics of what they did.
Thank you. That's all.
Seeing one more question.
Thank
Maybe
you, Mr.
Two.
In my defense, I'm just going to, it's actually just the second half of Senator Cuff's question. I think that we didn't get an answer to for the sponsor, Mr. Chair. And I think it's just on the question on the collective bargaining, Mr. Chair, Senator Curdy. I'm not aware of any collective bargaining unit on for seasonal firefighters that I'm aware of. Probably not a bad idea, but I'm not aware of one, so I just wanted to see if you could. I think you are the collective bargaining person basically right now, so just seeing if you could clarify that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Margeau, I can't answer the collective bargaining question because I can answer part of it. Because some of our firefighters are temporaries, they're not included under any collective bargaining act. Those folks who are state employees, I mean, career or the like, yes, they come under the bargaining unit.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions, Senator Lenz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the sponsor.
Senator
Mr. Curdy. Chair, Senator Lenz.
So, Senator Curdy, we're trying to define this line, and which that's, and so I'm trying to get my head around the actual wordage. We've talked about how many of the DNRC people would be in the office, but I also know DNRC has a lot of flexibility for people that are qualified firefighters that work in the office. And what the bill actually says is the salary of a wildland firefighter who holds a current incident qualification card and is engaged, so not doesn't mention a Pulaski or a shovel, engaged on a wildland fire as defined in the law, must be supplemented with. And so I want to set for you to define for me, if you could, does, because we kind of made it sound like somebody's only going to be sitting in a truck, but if they're going with incident command or they're on oversight on the fire or whatever that is still engaged on the fire. Could you speak to that?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Lenz, so anybody who is on a fire, whether you are actually working online or in camp and plans and the like, you have to have a red card. So that's why we mentioned the qualification card. It's pretty standard operation. So, again, we go back to the point of who qualifies for hazard pay. So, again, that is anybody who is actually on the line, whether it be, let's say, a safety officer, a division supervisor overhead who's walking the line, supervising firefighters who actually are working, for folks who are sitting in camp doing plans, the fire behavior analyst, those folks, they are not on the line. They're in camp. They don't qualify. This is for folks actually working on or within, working on the line.
Follow up. Then would you be open to amendment to define engaged?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lenz, if it's something that the committee wanted to do, it's your prerogative.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Senator, you care to close, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Great hearing, great questions. And again, the point here is we are trying to keep our firefighters. We have some really great people out there who work for us, but there are other opportunities out there that lure them away. And I can tell you that in order to have a safe, effective fire program, we need to make sure that we keep our morale up, we keep our employees And this is one way in which we can do that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Curdy. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 402. Members of the committee, we're going to take a short recess. We'll be back at quarter after to do the last bill of the day. Members, we are going to bring finance and claims back to order. We are going to hear Senate Bill 442. Senator Lang, you may open on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Lang. I'm from Senate District 17, which runs from where the Milk River comes into Havermont or the Hill County, runs on east and hits the Missouri River and exits the state. And I'm north of there, clear to a town called Westby, Montana. I live in Malta, Montana. Thank you for letting me be here this morning to talk about access to for access of habitat. That's what this fiscal note is all about. It's creating a methodology. God placed on this great state of Montana lots of habitat. No matter wherever you go, there's lots of habitat. We create a lot of public access to that. We have a lot of private access to. We have a lot of federal access. This bill takes some the money and puts it toward access so that you can get to the habitat in the state of Montana. I guess I'll wait for comments, and we're talking about the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We're going to open the hearing to proponents. Remember, we're dealing with the fiscal impact of the bill. We've heard it a couple times already. So, first proponent.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Todd Devlin, D-E-V-L-I-N, Todd with two D's. I'm a Perry County Commissioner, past president of MACO, vice chair of the Montana Association of Counties Public Lands Committee, and I'm also the National Association of Counties Public Lands Steering Committee chair, which I have about 85 commissioners from all over the United States on my committee. Perry County is blessed with a tremendous amount of block management. We have one of the largest block management, I do believe, in the state. It's a real impact to our county roads. I'll try to stay on the fiscal note, but I want to just really shortly, if I can, explain why MACO's here because of our policy. Our policy says we support efforts to maintain and improve existing public land roads and access points with adequate federal or state funding appropriated for that purpose, end of quote. So we think that Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, through the Pittman-Roberts and Dingell-Johnson money, they get about $20 million that they can use for the purpose that this one of the options of this money was going to be used for, and we think that access to public lands and state lands and private ground is very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Devlin. Welcome back. For the proponents.
Yes, my name is Larry Hendrickson, H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. I'm here on behalf of Liberty County Commissioners. I am a Liberty County Commissioner. So, right now, all the sportsmen in this room just been notified by email from Fish, Wildlife, and Parks that you have to renew your license. And so you're going to renew your license. You're going to make plans to go on your hunt this fall. Hunting season starts in the middle of August, runs through the first part of December for general season. You're going to come no matter what the road conditions are, no matter what, because you've already made vacation plans. So in Liberty County, we have a lot of state land. We have a lot of block management. After the hunters come and exercise their rights in our community, which they're totally welcome to, it costs us $1,000 a day to put the grader back on the road. That's for the equipment costs, the depreciation, the fuel, the wages, insurance, and everything else. So that tax burden is borne by the residents of Liberty County to fix the roads after the recreationists have left. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hendrickson. Further proponents of the bill.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Shelby DeMars, that's D-E-M-A-R-S. Here today on behalf of the Montana Association of Oil, Gas, and Coal Counties, we also rise in support of the bill. We think it's really critical that we take care of our roads. As was mentioned before, we have all this wonderful access. But if people can't access it, that's, you know, something that we need to make sure that we're maintaining and fixing along the way. And I think this bill does that. I'd also like to mention that I'm also here today on behalf of the United Property Owners of Montana. We also feel like this bill is a very astute use of those funds, and we would encourage your support.
Thank you. For the proponents, Mr. James.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Daryl James is D-A-R-R-Y-L. James is the common spelling. I'm with the Montana Infrastructure Coalition. Mr. Chair, members, I think this bill amounts to what is sound fiscal policy, whether you're talking about a business or a home or public lands. If you use the approach that you only build what you can maintain, this bill makes a whole lot of sense. You don't overbuild your home if you can't maintain it. You don't overbuild your business if you can't maintain it. Not to take away from Habitat Montana or the public lands that we secure, if we can't provide adequate access to those public lands, we're overbuilding, we're overacquiring. So from that standpoint, it makes a whole lot of sense. And as was already indicated, this is not a zero-sum game where you're taking money away from a program and obliterating that. There are adequate funds to make sure that that things like Habitat Montana can continue to be funded. This puts money where it needs to be put with county roads that we know we can't maintain because we don't have adequate funding. It also lessens that local property tax burden. So with that, Mr. Chair, we urge your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents? Further proponents in the room? I don't see any online.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There are no proponents online, only opponents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Gotcha. Any opponents in the room?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ben Lamb, L-A-M-B, representing the Montana Wildlife Federation. Unfortunately, you know, opposed to the allocation here. The voters under I-190 had asked the legislature to set some funding aside for habitat, and under House Bill 701 last session, 20% was allocated to this very important program. And so we just, you know, we totally sympathize with the issue. We agree that county roads need some attention. However, with historic surpluses and much larger than anticipated revenue coming in from this tax revenue stream, we feel like a better approach would be to take this out of the general fund. And if that amendment were put on this bill, then I think a lot of the opposition would flip to support so long as the 20% for Habitat Montana is restored. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Further opponents in the room?
Mr. Chair, welcome. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Leo. Last name is spelled L-E-O-W, and I'm here representing the Montana chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, regretfully standing in opposition to Senate Bill 442. Habitat Montana is our state's best tool to keep Montana, Montana. With the development pressure Montana is experiencing and with increased pressure on our outdoor recreational resources, Habitat Montana is more important than ever. This vital program keeps Montana family farms and ranches in production and provides hunting and fishing opportunities for all Montanans now and for future generations. We also understand that the county road maintenance need is real. We are sympathetic to the counties, to the sponsor, and his intent with this bill. But taking the money from Habitat Montana does not need to be the solution. As Mr. Lamb pointed out, we have a record surplus. We also are enjoying more marijuana tax revenue than anticipated, and so we don't need to take the money away from Habitat Montana in order to fund this other important purpose. We ask that House Bill 442 be amended to restore the 20% funding for Habitat while creating a new revenue account for county roads and dedicating a portion of the marijuana tax revenue for that purpose. And so with that, we do ask that you amend the bill so that we can fund both important purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leo. Further opponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jocelyn LaRue, that's L-E-R-O-U-X, and I'm here today on behalf of Montana Conservation Voters to respectfully oppose Senate Bill 442 for the reasons that you have heard from the two folks before me. Habitat Montana is an incredibly important program. County roads are also incredibly important, and we believe this bill sets up a choice that does not need to be made due to what was said before me about the amount of marijuana tax revenue that we are seeing coming into the state. So we ask for you to amend the bill and oppose it as currently written. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. LaRue. Further opponents in the room? Opponents? Katya? Queue up the first opponent online.
Mr. Chairman, members of committee, I am Bert Lindler, L-I-N-D-L-E-R. My reluctant vote to legalize recreational marijuana hinged on distribution of taxes to remedy some of the anticipated problems and to provide funding for non-game wildlife and acquisition of wildlife habitat. I'm a city resident who relies on Montana's public lands for my hunting and other recreation. Habitat for many others like me. I want to make sure that publicly accessible wildlife habitat awaits me at the end of my drive. Please do not reduce Habitat Montana's marijuana tax funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindner. And I'm assuming you all heard we're speaking mostly to the fiscal note. Next, Mr. Marion.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Great. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Noah Marion. Last name is spelled M-A-R-I-O-N. Apologies for not being able to be there in person today, as I normally would be. I had an obligation at home that I could not reschedule, but happy to be able to be here on Zoom today. As the bill is currently written, we do oppose, as it eliminates a significant revenue source for Habitat Montana. But thankfully, this committee has the ability to fund all of these important priorities. To put a finer point on it, even adding Habitat Montana at 20% back into this allocation formula, according to the Office of Budget and Policy Planning, would leave their revenue estimates would leave still $73 million this biennium going into the general fund from this revenue source. But I am more than happy to work with the sponsor and the committee to meet all of these critical needs for Montanans. And I thank you for your consideration for restoring the Habitat Montana allocation.
Thank you, sir. Next opponent online. Go ahead,
Mr. Sir. Chair, members of the committee, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
My name is Jack Cunningham, spelled C-O-N-Y-N-G-H-A-M. I echo the other opponents who have spoken in noting the false dichotomy between two worthy programs and needs in this period of budget surplus. As a new point, I would just add that we all know that real estate values and therefore conservation easements are skyrocketing in value. So it's very important that Habitat Montana maintain or increase its funding just to maintain its current level of effectiveness. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Cunningham. Further opponents in the room other than the little dog? Informational witnesses.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Larry Flynn, FLYNN. I'm the CFO for the Department of Transportation. If passed, these dollars would be appropriated to us as a pass-through agency. So we are here for questions on the fiscal note or the appropriation process. Thank you.
Thank you. Further informational witnesses in the room? Anybody else online, Katya?
Mr. Chair, there is nobody else online to speak on this bill.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Bartel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to speak to the fiscal note of some of the things that we've heard today. One of them is there is a lot of habitat money in other accounts. And I think this is a perfect place to take this money to maintain these roads. The recreation folks need to understand one thing, and I'm one of those senators that live out in these recreational areas. And the recreationists are a huge impact to our roads because everybody knows what gumbo is and everybody knows what non-serviceable roads are and how they get tore up. And typically then the locals, through the local tax mills, has to pay for that. And so I think if this is not going to replace what local mills are, this money is going to just help us maintain those areas so the folks can get to the habitat areas that are being provided by other funding sources. So thank you.
Was that a question for the sponsor to elaborate on? Senator Cuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Flynn. Mr. Flynn from the Highway Department.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Flynn. I believe that should this money, should this pass, and should the money come into your department, that there's a process already existing that would allow for the dispersal of the money out to the various counties. Can you describe that, Mr. Flynn, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cuff, this would be akin to the current gas tax distributions. We collect gas tax for the state. There's right now, actually, there's a bill that just passed that simplified that process. There's a formula that's contained in this bill that would tell us exactly how to allocate that to the and when to allocate those dollars to the counties, and we would just follow the formula and distribute the funds as they come in. One little technical snag in the bill, there is no appropriation for these dollars contained currently. It would either have to be amended into House Bill 2 or through a statutory appropriation or something, but I believe they have to do that in the House.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, one follow-up.
Senator Cuff.
So as Senator Bartel was talking about, the need for this money, will it get out to the sparsely populated areas where it's truly needed, or will it slide into the more populated urban areas?
Mr. Chair, the formula is pretty descriptive, prescriptive, and I believe, yes, it does get out to all the rural areas as well. It's I don't have the bill right in front of me. I have the fiscal note, but yes, it's based on land area and that kind of thing, so it should be pretty well evenly spread.
Okay, Mr. Flynn, just to elaborate on that, it's based on number of miles of certain types of roads, I think.
Yes.
Yes. Further questions? Senator Flowers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the sponsor.
Senator Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Flowers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lang, happy St. Patty's Day to a fellow Brady.
Yes, same to you, sir.
I understand the need, and I've heard this from many county commissioners in southwest Montana in my experience on the same issue. Maybe they don't have the level of challenge on the gumbo roads, but it's still been an issue down there. So I certainly get the concern and I understand some of the logic that brought you to this point. I assume the bottom line for you and your interest on this bill is finding a way to get this done rather than the specific source of funds. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Flowers, I guess we'd have to define specific. I am pretty adamant that this is a access way for habitat, and without having access to the habitat or maintaining the road or any kind of access to that, the habitat is unreachable by the majority. So that's why this was selected this way.
Okay. Well, thank you. No, that's good.
But Senator, as you know in our discussions over the past, nothing's final until it's final. Thank you.
Further questions of anyone? Seeing none, Senator Lang, you can close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry for neglecting Senator Cuff when I started to open. I should have went into the ratios and how this formula came up. The formula basically was, and we're 50% of the formula comes from rural county roads, and that is a, as Mr. Flynn talked, that number is already in the state coffers. We aren't going out and having counties fudge a road. They have a number there. That's the number that we used. And then 50% of the ratio was the number of acres enrolled in block management and wildlife management areas. And 25% of that ratio is also developed from state and federal lands, because we have a lot of access that needs to go to state and federal lands in each county. So, and all the counties of the state of Montana qualify for this at some point, somehow. The thing that I want to reiterate about the fiscal note, and we've talked, and all of you know through the legislature, that costs have gone up on everything. And it was mentioned that counties should use this for themselves. Well, if the roads are messed up, which they are, and we hopefully have them prepared or get them prepared before hunting comes, but the real problem is getting out there before winter sets in to get everything done. And those costs have just risen like everything else we've talked about in the last 45 days at this legislature. The cost of a road grader, the cost. And the average, just on the miles, of the average number we had, the counties, that did not become part of the formula. But when I preliminary this, it was about $1,500 to $1,700 a mile just for maintenance of a county road. So I think it's we want access. We want that to people to enjoy Montana. They live here. They want to enjoy the outdoors. Since COVID, I think that's one of the reasons we have the multiplier effect here, is that there's a lot more people enjoying the outdoors, and that puts a lot more stress on our county budgets and our county roads. And we always want rain, but rain makes messy roads, and when people drive on, they're really messy. Thank you very much. Please pass this bill.
Thank you, Senator Lang. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 442. Members of the committee, just about everything we have in here is had amendments requested for or potentially requested for. The only one that maybe doesn't is House Bill 181. Vice Chair Glimcher, do you remember? I don't know of anything requested for that. Does anybody else? Let's take that out of our packet. Deal with that one. I guess, members of the committee, there was a potential for an amendment that rumbled around over here somewhere. Yes. The potential for amendment went away. All right. Vice Chair Glimm.
Mr. Chairman, I move do concur on House Bill 181. This was by Representative Rexton, an act revising the education laws related to the superintendent of public instruction. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Discussion on the bill. Any discussion? Senator Solomon.
I'll run it by a little bit. This is a bill clarifying superintendent of public instruction. We wanted to make sure that it opened it up for people in the business world, the military world, and all the things that entails, because running a state office of public instruction involves significant amount of financial incentive to understand it and various things. So we're just opening it up to more people. Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Seeing none, shall we try a voice vote? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Let's try a roll call vote.
Vice Chair Glim?
Yes.
Vice Chair Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Solomon?
Yes.
Senator McGilvery?
Yes.
Senator Boldman?
No, by proxy.
Senator Bartel?
Yes, by proxy.
Senator Mandeville?
Yes.
Senator Morgeau?
No.
Senator Lentz?
Nay.
Senator Lang?
Yes.
Senator Lynch?
No, by proxy.
Senator Bogner?
Yes, by proxy.
Senator Cuff?
Yes.
Senator Flowers?
No.
Senator Fuller?
Yes.
Senator Vance?
Yes.
Senator Pope?
No.
Senator Wellborn?
No.
Chairman Esp?
No.
11 votes yes, 8 votes no.
Senate Bill, House Bill 181 has been concurred in. Looking at the sponsors, does anybody volunteer to carry it? Senator Solomon. I think as I look at this, everything else has amendments requested or potential amendments. The fire hazard pay, I may have some thoughts. I think, Senator Fuller, do you have an amendment that you're going to offer in on this side of the...
Mr. Chair, no. Oh, I'm not going to bring the amendment to reveal the... I'm copacetic with the 10-year sunset.
Okay. So maybe we can move that one today. Vice Chair Glim.
Mr. Chairman, I move due pass on Senate Bill 104. By Senator Fuller, exempting military pensions from income tax.
Senator Fuller, would you like to discuss your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I stated earlier, the object of the bill is to improve the financial well-being and encourage the economic development of Montana by making it hospitable for this category of well-trained, skilled workforce to come back home to Montana. Consequently, I think it'll work. I understand why there are opponents to the sunset, but I'm copacetic with it because within a decade we should see and be able to see if that number has increased. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Senator Morgeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support this. I think it's the least we can do for our military folks. And, I had a similar bill to this as well, and I'm grateful for Senator Fuller bringing this forward. So very appreciative. Thank you.
Senator Lenz.
Mr. Chair, as much as I appreciate the good Senator Fuller, he is... sincere in his approach. I do not think this bill in any part here will make Montana more welcoming. I think we're welcoming enough already, and we are already welcoming military families that then step into our system, pay taxes along with fellow Montanans. They are military folks, are great people, as are the farmers, teachers, firefighters, grocers in this state, all working together, Mr. Chair. And reluctantly, because it's Senator Fuller's bill, I will be a no.
Further discussion, Senator Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Senator Fuller, just to get my brain around the military acronyms.
Senator Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fuller, does this bill then, does it mean if you don't retire as a military, you get no, if you enlist for the military for 4 years and then you go do your regular life, I assume you don't get a pension for that. I don't know how that works. Would you please explain?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lange, you are correct. There's a difference between veterans who served anywhere from 2 to 4 or even, in my case, like 6 years or whatever, but then you elapse time in service or ETS from the military and go on with a private career. And those who, especially since 1973, go on and become, have a professional career. And until just recently, in order to get any kind of pension benefits whatsoever, you had to serve 20 years. And being serving the 20 years, you also had to demonstrate proficiency. It was, they called it up or out. In other words, you had to get promoted to increasing rank and responsibility, or else you were told to leave the service. And so that's the difference. This applies only to those who are retired military service personnel. But as I mentioned, Mr. Chair, with your forbearance, they are now providing basically a lot of professional military are on pretty much a 401k type situation where they are going to be getting an annuity, and those individuals will be, as time goes by, less in number, and of course their retirement annuity has age requirements as well, like any others. And so I predict that after a period of time, that was one reason why I'm copacetic with the sunset. I predict after a period of time, we will find that the number of the economic impact of loss of revenue will diminish because the pensions are less. But at the same time, we're hoping to increase their quantity here. And so, Mr. Chair, I offer to you the fact that I think that the end result is a win-win for Montana. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller.
Further comments, questions? Senator Fuller. I mean, Senator Flowers.
Yeah.
Thank you look Mr. so much alike.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that's Senator Vermeer, I'm told, but my doppelganger. I haven't had the chance to talk to Senator Fuller about this offline, and I do want to follow up, make sure I understand that kind of discussion we had earlier about whether this applies to your military retirement or your income earned, whichever is smaller. I'm trying to understand the implications of that. So given that option, does that mean that the loss of income tax revenue to the state is going to be less rather than more? If it only applied to military pension, period, would that potentially be more of a loss in tax revenue than the option of whichever is less? Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, if I interpret your question correctly, if it applied only to military pensions, the reduction in revenue to the state would be greater. This is an incentive to come to Montana and make a job that contributes to the economy in a large measure. Okay, and so if you come to Montana and have an economic activity that is greater, that their economic rewards or pension or salary or whatever or profits are greater than your pension, you are going to be able to exempt your military pension because that's a lesser amount, and your private Montana wage labor income is subject to the normal taxation.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. That helps. The only follow-up I have then is
You've got a sunset on there with the intent of being able to assess at the end of the sunset period whether it's delivering on the benefits of this for the overall economy and tax income, kind of in a broader sense. What's going to compel us as a body or to then do the analysis to make that assessment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. I'm hoping that there will be a new senator here who will be as passionate about this subject as I am, and we're going to bring it to the new legislature's attention.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope you're right, and you may very well be right. My only sense is that we all have a short memory here, and as we transition out, sometimes that kind of knowledge isn't passed. I wouldn't recommend this today, but I'm kind of thinking ahead maybe as a floor amendment. Is there any way to build in some kind of required look back so we actually can assess this and guarantee that we assess this and this will kind of pop up on the calendar and force that assessment? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, since this has been heard on the floor, a second reading, Senator, then I would suggest that that is a possibility in the House.
Question.
I saw Senator Bogner's hand just before you asked the question. Senator Bogner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your, ignoring question, but... And I kind of came in a little late, so I'm hoping not reiterating anything, but this is a great workforce development bill, especially as my generation of veterans who fought the global war on terror begin to retire. And as my friends that are still in get to that point where they have to decide where to go after the military, I know they shop around and they want to know where they're wanted. And I think Montana should want these individuals. They've developed the skills that we want working here in Montana. This makes sure that they are working. And, you know, there's certain people I think we have reservations about moving into the state, but these are the type of people we want here, especially with our large veteran population that makes Montana, Montana. And this is a great start as they look to get out of the military and where they're wanted and needed. And Montana is a great home for them.
Thank you, Senator Bogner. The question's been called. We'll do a roll call vote.
Vice Chair Glimm.
Yes.
Vice Chair Ellis.
Yes.
Senator Solomon.
Yes.
Senator McGilvery.
No.
Senator Boldman.
Yes, by proxy.
Senator Bartel.
No, by proxy.
Senator Mandeville.
Yes.
Senator Morgeau.
Yes.
Senator Lenz.
Nay.
Senator Lang.
Yes.
Senator Lynch.
Yes, by proxy.
Senator Bogner.
Yes.
Senator Cuff.
Yes.
Senator Flowers.
Yes.
Senator Fuller.
Yes.
Senator Vance.
Yes.
Senator Pope.
Yes.
Senator Wellborn.
Yes.
Chairman Asp.
No.
15 votes yes, 4 votes no.
And members of the committee, the motion carries. And I guess Senator Fuller will just go to third reading on it. And just so you know, I oppose this sort of a bill because I don't think it's good tax policy, not because I don't appreciate the fact what you're folks have done in the service of our country. I've always opposed targeted tax credits and targeted tax reductions. So, with that being said, any other business to come before us? Seeing none, meeting's adjourned.
Happy.